KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201 DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. In just days, President Trump rewrote immigration policy and rolled out workplace raids. What's the legal foundation? We ask an acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement in the Obama administration on Morning Edition from NPR News. Tens of thousands of Palestinians are walking back to what's left of their homes in Gaza City in the north of the Palestinian territory. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadil. It's being called the March of Return. In Las Vegas, President Trump vowed to deliver on a campaign promise, no taxes on tips. It's Monday, January 27th. On this day in 1945, Soviet troops entered Auschwitz, Poland, and freed the survivors of concentration camps. It was only then the world got to see just how unimaginable the atrocities committed there were. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Kristen Wright. The White House says it's reached an agreement with the Colombian government to send deported migrants to the South American country. President Trump and Colombian President Gustavo Petro traded threats of steep tariffs Sunday after Bogota turned away two U.S. military flights of migrants from Colombia. ICE, or U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and other agencies are continuing raids to arrest people in the country without legal status. President Trump signaled once again his interest in Canada becoming a U.S. state. NPR's Mara Liasson has more.
Talking to reporters on Air Force One this weekend, President Trump repeated his threat to somehow make Canada the 51st state. He said he would first pressure Canada by putting 25% tariffs on Canadian imports starting February 1st. Tariffs that are prohibited by the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement, an agreement negotiated by Trump himself in his first term. Trump went on to claim without evidence that Canada wouldn't survive without what he says, falsely, is $250 billion in subsidies from the U.S. Mara Liasson, NPR News.
Several federal agencies are without an inspector general now, including the Departments of Defense, State, and Health and Human Services. President Trump fired them Friday. The independent watchdogs work within agencies to call out waste, fraud, and abuse of power. Glenn Fine served as the Justice Department's inspector general for more than a decade.
IGs are supposed to be nonpartisan. They're to be selected according to the IG Act without regard to their political affiliation. And their effectiveness depends on them being non-political. And so it is important that they be viewed as not tied to one party or another.
Fine spoke to NPR's Morning Edition. Trump fired the IGs without giving Congress the 30-day notice required by law. In the Mideast ceasefire, displaced Palestinians are returning to northern Gaza for the first time in more than a year. Israeli forces unblocked roads leading north. Thousands of Afghans who worked for or fought alongside Americans and hoped to come to the U.S. are now in limbo after President Trump ordered the suspension of the country's refugee program. NPR's Diyad Hadid reports.
Resettlement advocates say Afghans who allied with the United States before the Taliban seized power in Afghanistan in August 2021 faced the risk of death for their actions. There's about 50,000 Afghans waiting to have their asylum applications processed. Many of them have been waiting in neighboring Pakistan, but they aren't welcome there. The Pakistani government has been deporting hundreds of thousands of Afghans, arguing it cannot shoulder the burden of hosting so many people. Five Afghans who are expecting to fly to the United States with their families told NPR they feel abandoned and betrayed. Diya Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
This is NPR News in Washington. Much-needed rain is falling across parts of Southern California, which is helping firefighters as they make progress in containing wildfires. But it's also raising worries of mudslides and toxic ash. NPR's Chandelise Duster reports.
The National Weather Service has issued a flood watch for parts of Los Angeles County scorched by the fires. And officials are cautioning those who return to their homes to be careful of toxic material. Los Angeles County Department of Public Health Director Dr. Barbara Furrier.
Heavy metals such as lead and arsenic can come from burned electronics and building materials. And even a brief exposure can potentially cause skin irritations and lead to more serious illness.
Residents are also advised to wear an N95 mask to not inhale smoke and ash. Chantalise Duster, NPR News.
The three largest fires in Southern California are nearing full containment at more than 90%. 28 people died as a result of the wildfires, and more than 16,000 homes, businesses, and other structures have been destroyed now. The Super Bowl matchup is set. The Kansas City Chiefs will play for a three-peat against the Philadelphia Eagles. In the AFC Championship game last night, the Chiefs beat Buffalo 32-29. The Eagles beat the Commanders in the NFC. It was not a close game. Philly won 55-23. Super Bowl 59 will be played at the Superdome in New Orleans February 9th. A Chiefs Super Bowl win would be the first time any team recorded three consecutive Super Bowl victories. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Amazon Business, committed to being a digital purchasing solution for businesses so that growing the business is the main focus and not admin and paperwork. Learn about smart business buying at AmazonBusiness.com.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm E. Martinez in Culver City, California.
And I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C. Good morning. Tens of thousands of Palestinians are being allowed to go home. Now they're discovering the fate of those homes. Coming up, we'll hear about Gaza's march of return to the north. But first, President Trump's first week in office saw him giving immigration authorities the power to sidestep the courts to expel migrants without legal documentation more quickly. And workplace immigration raids began in cities like Chicago and Newark, New Jersey. Newark's mayor, Ross Baraka, told reporters last week that a raid in his city was unconstitutional.
Some ICE agents raided a business in our city without a warrant. We believe that there were three people who they say were undocumented that they detained, but they also detained folks that were, in fact, citizens.
John Sandweg served as acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, during the second Obama administration. He's a partner now in the law firm Nixon Peabody, where he leads the cross-border risks team. Good morning. Thank you for being on the program.
Yeah, my pleasure.
So in your experience as a former ICE director, if a migrant loses the chance to plead their case in an immigration court, how will this support President Trump's goals of deporting en masse people without documentation?
Sure. Probably the biggest challenge he faces to executing a mass deportation plan is the backlogs in our immigration courts. Most of the migrants who have been present in the United States cannot be deported unless and until an immigration judge issues a final order of removal. The challenge, though, has been over the last 8 years, we've had these massive numbers of asylum cases that have added to the backlogs in the immigration courts, creating more than 3 million cases for 900 judges. When kind of planning this, you could tell that they were looking at how do we get around the immigration courts entirely. And he's done that by labeling this a foreign invasion, which I think he hopes will allow him to use the Alien Enemies Act.
Well, that's a wartime authority, and the U.S. is not at war. What's the argument to invoke this?
You know, again, he's characterizing this as an invasion. So he's trying to draw on the military authorities, which would then give him his unilateral discretion as commander-in-chief to say, we're going to bypass these courts entirely, allowing us to fast-track the deportation.
Who are the likely targets of these raids?
Well, the problem is this. We don't, you know, he's saying they're going to focus on criminals. We're saying the focus is going to be on individuals who pose a threat to public safety. But the reality is there just aren't enough of those individuals in this country. So I think as this thing goes forward and we start filling, you know, the hundreds of thousands of deportations he's looking for, we're going to start drawing on the population that's been here a long time. And all the demographics suggest that most migrants have been in this country for more than 10 years of the undocumented. There are 4.4 million mixed status families.
4.4 million mixed status families.
That is U.S. citizen children who have an undocumented parent. And so as you go forward and you start looking to deport hundreds of thousands, you run out of the people who have a nexus to the public safety. You know, ICE, in 2019, ICE arrested only 123,000 people who had any nexus to the criminal justice system. So what happens is you start doing these worksite raids, you start looking for people who are undocumented in this country. You just run out of those targets that have the nexus to the criminal justice system or who pose a threat to public safety. What you start getting are these people who have been in this country a long time, who have developed ties to this country, who started, you know, had married U.S. citizen spouses or had U.S. citizen children. You just, again, there's just not enough of a population here to say we're going to do a mass deportation and focus exclusively on the criminal population.
What about capacity? I mean, does ICE have the capacity and the funding to carry out these mass deportations?
Historically, ICE only has the capacity to remove about 250,000 people mm-hmm. from the interior of the United States. So what the president has done here is drawn on the full resources of the federal government in order to handle this, right? So he, by declaring it a foreign invasion, allows him to tap into military resources. We saw that this weekend with the military flights, which boost ICE's transportation capacity. He's also directed the Department of Defense to bolster detention space inside military bases. ICE is funded to detain about 40,000 migrants on a given day. This would increase potentially, I mean, we'll see what he's planning on doing, but dramatically ICE's detention capacity. And then the arrest capacity, you know, ICE has the, you know, can arrest traditionally about 150 to 200,000 migrants in the interior of the United States annually. So the president has directed the Department of Justice, you know, deputizing all the federal agents of ATF, DEA, the FBI, to also bolster that arrest capacity. I expect in the next couple of weeks, we're going to see a number of state and local authorities, you know, sheriff's offices, maybe police departments, also start getting the authority to arrest migrants as well. So you could see, you know, he's leveraging the entire resources of the federal government in order to make mass deportation a reality.
John Sandwig was acting director of Immigration and Customs Enforcement during the second Obama administration. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Today, tens of thousands of Palestinians in Gaza are returning home for the first time in more than a year.
This march home to Gaza City and other places in the north is a huge moment for families who've been displaced in the war. It comes after Hamas and Israel agreed last night to an additional exchange of hostages and prisoners and detainees, with more people expected to be freed in the coming days.
We're joined now by international correspondent Eyya Badrawi, who's been following this closely from Dubai. So let's start with the people returning to Gaza City this morning. Take us back to why they were displaced at all.
Hi, A. Yeah, I mean, look, a few days after Hamas militants attacked Israel on October 7th of 2023, Israel ordered Palestinians to leave their homes in Gaza City and the north. And so more than a million people heeded those orders, leaving with just a few belongings, and many never imagined it would be 16 months of displacement. And during the war, Israeli forces carved out this miles-wide corridor isolating Gaza City in the north from the rest of the territory. But today, troops partly withdrew, allowing people to return. And this is a direct result of complex talks happening regarding the release of hostages and prisoners in the ceasefire. And so, A, for the first time since I've been reporting on this war, I could hear a level of joy in Gaza I have not heard before. And you can hear an NPR producer, Anas Baba's voice. I reached him by phone as he was walking among huge crowds back to his home in Gaza City. Have a listen.
I only want to walk to my house, to Gaza City, just the happiness inside you is driving you all the way. I'm feeling truly, Aya, that every single step that I'm taking is truly taking me to the heaven, not to Gaza. It's just like after all of that patience, after all of that missing for Gaza City, now we're being reunited again.
You know, we've been hearing his great reporting on all of this for over a year, so it's really nice to hear the joy in his voice. But what will he be going back to?
Yeah, I mean, look, Israeli airstrikes have destroyed tens of thousands of buildings, and survivors of these airstrikes tell us that under the rubble are entire families, thousands of bodies that have not been retrieved. The UN also says there are unexploded bombs amid all this debris. posing a huge risk to people. But Anas says people in Gaza have been living without electricity or adequate shelter for over a year now, displaced in other parts. So they're ready to set up tents atop the rubble of their homes. And they will be heavily relying on UN aid for basics like food and water. And there's also this reality, eh? Many people are returning without those they left with. Parents are returning without all of their kids, and children are returning without their parents. Thousands of Palestinians were killed while they were seeking shelter in southern parts of Gaza in the war.
Right. Now, what's the reaction in Israel been to the ceasefire deal so far?
Well, many in Israel are relieved that hostages are being freed in the ceasefire, and there will be 3 additional people freed this week. That's out of 90 still held in Gaza, many believed to be alive. Hamas has already freed 7 Israeli women in exchange for nearly 300 Palestinians held in Israeli prisons just in the first week of the ceasefire. But there are also people on the far right in Israel angry with this deal. They want Israel to return to war, and they argue that this deal leaves Hamas in power. It's also worth mentioning, this isn't the only ceasefire in place in the region right now. The one that halted fighting between Israel and Lebanon's Hezbollah group was just extended for 3 more weeks. That's despite more than 20 people killed in Lebanon yesterday trying to return home to their villages in or near areas still controlled by Israel.
That's NPR's Aya Batraoui joining us from Dubai. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The world's biggest iceberg is on a collision course with a tiny island in the South Atlantic. The massive ice chunk goes by the unassuming name of A23A.
A23A is huge. 1,400 square miles. It's about the size of Rhode Island.
Nick Holshue teaches geology at Amherst College and studies the Antarctic ice sheet.
A23A broke away from the Antarctic ice sheet in 1986. It was fully floating, but it ran aground in the Southern Ocean where the waters are extremely cold, and it was stuck on the ground where it sat for 34 years.
In December, A23A began moving and got caught in a powerful ocean current local sailors and fishermen call Iceberg Alley.
Where they get transported up near the Antarctic Peninsula out into the Antarctic Circumpolar Current where it is now being sent towards South Georgia.
South Georgia is a small British territory in the Atlantic, over 1,100 miles from Argentina's mainland. Only a handful of people live there, but the island is home to millions of seals and nearly half the world's population of king penguins.
Scientists worry that if A23A runs aground and breaks apart, large chunks of ice could clog important wildlife feeding areas. But Holshue says it's too early to tell if that's going to happen.
If it ends up on a different path, it may end out in the deep ocean where it will slowly melt and break down by warm surface waters.
Holshue says climate change has little to do with A23A's history because it broke off the Antarctic shelf so many years ago.
There are other places around the Antarctic ice sheet where warming ocean waters melt away some of these floating ice shelves. It's like uncorking the bottle.
Scientists think it's possible climate change is leading to a growing number of icebergs. What they know for sure is that climate change is affecting Antarctic ice. And
we know with high confidence that the primary driver of climate change is fossil fuels. So when I think about my role in addressing future climate change, I do feel some personal responsibility, but I also want to motivate my communities, my state, my country to move towards alternative energy, which is important for kind of our net contribution.
A23A is now about 170 miles away from the little island named South Georgia. It's hard to predict when or if it will hit.
Holshue says he'll be watching to see how the journey ends. This is NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, as part of Saturday Night Live's 50th anniversary celebration, Amir Questlove Thompson has co-directed a new documentary about the show's musical guests and musical sketches. He'll share behind-the-scenes stories and tell us how the SNL band influenced him as leader of The Roots, the Tonight Show's house band. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases and supporting land conservation initiatives. From the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. From the Wallace Foundation, working to develop and share practices that can improve learning and enrichment for young people and the vitality of the arts for everyone. Ideas and information at wallacefoundation.org. And from the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. A recent skit on Saturday Night Live featured a panel of cable TV news talent.
Hello and welcome to MSNBC. I'm Rachel Maddow.
They're trying to report on the inauguration of President Trump, but each time they analyze something Trump did, they are interrupted by news of something else Trump did.
One thing I do know is this time around, we're not going to get sucked in by every new shiny crazy statement from Trump. We need to focus on what he does, not what he says. I'm sorry, I have to interrupt you. We have some breaking news. Trump has apparently just told reporters that he would
like... One of the
like
panelists parodied in this skit is MSNBC program host Chris Hayes. Of course, the real Chris Hayes saw the skit and felt it could not be better timed.
Interestingly, it was a satirization of precisely the conundrum I wrote the whole book about.
That new book is called The Siren's Call. It's about the battle for attention, which internet companies, advertisers, entertainers, and politicians demand of us so constantly that we can't pay attention. You say this is not the information age, it's the attention age. What do you mean?
Information is generative, it's infinite. The thing that is finite in the information age, as we call it, is attention. If 10 firms have your data or 1,000 do, it doesn't make that big a difference in your life. But if someone has your attention, someone else can't have it. And that does make a difference in your life.
I thought at first when I started this book that you were going to tell me about social media and the demands of social media. And you do, and the demands of your phone. But you mentioned that every business is rewired for this. There are many businesses that are about the brand, which is seizing attention, and not really even about the product. They could care less about the product.
This is one of the strange things about the age we live in which, because of sort of the global industrial production and outsourcing, the actual product has become very secondary to the brand. I mean, the swoosh is what has value for Nike much more than the physical sneaker.
You're in the attention business. What's it like to be in the attention business?
I don't think it's great for my psyche, but I think the insights that I've gleaned from being in the attention business, in which one always feels like one is chasing attention as opposed to directing it, which I think is the central experience of it. One of the insights I think I had over the course of the last 11 years that I've been hosting a cable news show is that this experience is actually being democratized before our eyes, that the experience of desperately chasing attention, trying to figure out the whims of where it's going and how to hold it, is increasingly the experience of more and more people, particularly a younger generation that is raised on producing content for social media, whose aspirations to be famous on social media or to go viral, be influencers, as polls reflect, become a kind of dominant social model of aspiration, that this experience is now increasing the experience everyone has.
Help me understand when you say you're chasing attention as opposed to something else. Somebody might think of you as someone who commands attention, who tells people what to think, or at least tells them what to pay attention to. You choose stories, people tune in. Is that not your experience?
It's not the subjective experience, I think, of doing my job. And I think many people in the media will tell you this, that if you're on the production side of media, you're trying to get people to read your stories or listen to your radio show or podcast or watch your television show, the attentional whims of the audience feel extraneous. And the way I compare it in the book is like wind to a sailor.
Oh, yeah. Lay this out. I like this analogy. Go on.
You can't control the wind, and you have to take it seriously as an actual force outside of you. If you don't do that, you're not going to get very far. At the same time, the craft that you develop over time is how to figure out how to use technique to capture that wind and move the boat in the direction you want to go. There are certain things that are capturing people's attention at a given moment, and I can't control them en masse. But what I can do is sort of sense where those winds are blowing and attempt to use my rhetorical toolkit to get the show and the audience's attention to end up in the destination that I want it to end up in.
How was the attention economy a factor in the rise of Donald Trump?
Well, I think he is the ultimate symbol of the attention age. I think because of his own personal profile, he has a kind of feral instinct for getting attention, a need for it that I think is boundless. And that need for it has led him into an insight that defines the attention age, which is that attention is the most important resource. And crucially, and this is a thing most politicians don't get, negative attention is just as good as positive attention, or at least it's better than no attention.
I'm thinking about Trump's media and political strategy and how it fits with some of the things that you write. You point out that it is easier to get someone's attention for a moment than it is to hold someone's attention. And Trump doesn't necessarily try to hold your attention. He gets it over and over again, just since the election. Let's take over Greenland. How about the Panama Canal? Canada. Let's rename Mount McKinley. We've gone on and on. Always there's a new thing to get our attention again.
This is exactly right. In fact, when he tries to hold attention, famously when he goes for 90 minutes at a rally, people leave.
Yep.
He's actually not good at holding attention. And this is a central dynamic of the attention age. It's replicated in the slot machine design of the algorithmic feed, where you just grab, 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 grab. You never hold attention. Everything's short. You go to the next one. Trump has the exact same, you're totally right, has the exact same approach to this. And that's because interruption and compelled attention are the circuitry that is easiest to fire in us.
The impression from the outside is that MSNBC is struggling to hold people's attention. Do you see it that way?
To go back to the wind metaphor, I think it's largely the wind at this moment. The best sailors in the world can't sail on a dead calm sea. And I think there's lots of people who have just tuned out after the election, and I totally understand that. I tend to think that is not a permanent state of affairs, the way the wind is never a permanent state of affairs. Mm-hmm. What I will say is that my experience of covering politics for the last 20 years is that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. And right now, I feel like there is a kind of pressing down of a spring happening in our politics amongst what I would call the almost 50% of the country that voted against Donald Trump, or the smaller percentage that deeply, deeply dislikes him and think he's bad for the country. And I can feel that spring being pushed down and pushed down and pushed down. And it's now out of view, but I don't think it's going to stay out of view.
Chris Hayes of MSNBC is the author of a new book, The Siren's Call: How Attention Became the World's Most Endangered Resource. Pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Steve.
Pay attention. This is NPR News.
Growing up, musician Nico Case knew very little about where she came from. She had no idea that her grandmother played in a band of her own, or that her aunt was a famous wrestler. Those were discoveries she stumbled into later in life.
You'll never know where you come from, because nobody's going to tell you.
Nico Case on her new memoir and upbringing on All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Dave Mattingly. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is calling state lawmakers into special session today. The governor wants them to take up proposals to help with President Trump's deportation efforts. NPR's Greg Allen says it's unclear what will get done this week.
Governor DeSantis says he's focused on immigration and could call lawmakers back into another special session if they don't take action now. But Republican leaders say the legislature will meet for its regular session in just over a month. They want to deal with immigration and other issues on their schedule and during that session.
One proposal before lawmakers would require local officials to help with deportations or face suspension. Crews in Southern California say rainy weather is helping them as they continue battling wildfires near Los Angeles and San Diego. However, the wet weather is also raising the risk of flooding and toxic ash runoff in areas scarred by the flames. Captain Eric Scott with the LA Fire Department says sandbags are being used in some places.
The rain can come down and not have the typical leaves to slow it down, so the impact on the ground itself is more intense.
Snow is falling at higher elevations in Southern California. Economists say they don't expect the Federal Reserve to make any changes to interest rates at this week's meeting, with inflation in the U.S. economy still elevated. This is NPR News from Washington. In the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, government forces and their allies defending the city of Goma appear to have collapsed. As Emmett Livingstone reports, it appears rebels backed by Rwanda are ready to take control.
First, there was a sound of distant artillery strikes, then later, heavy gunfire inside the city. Congolese forces defending the city of Goma in eastern Congo appear to have crumbled after days of intense combat. The M23 told Congolese soldiers they must hand over their arms to the UN peacekeeping force and present themselves at the city stadium. Hundreds of European private military contractors working for Congo's army have cut a deal with the rebels, according to security sources, and are waiting to evacuate. Sporadic gunfire can still be heard in the city, but the provincial leadership has fled. Goma residents are expecting to wake up to new masters in the morning, while the wider region holds its breath for what's next. For NPR News, I'm Emmett Livingstone in Goma.
Paul McCartney says he's concerned artificial intelligence will lead to AI companies ripping off artists. The 82-year-old former Beatle tells the BBC he's urging the British government not to change copyright laws in a way that makes it more difficult for artists to retain control of their work. Moments ago on Wall Street, stocks opened sharply lower amid investor concerns about the future of AI. The Nasdaq is down more than 600 points or more than 3%. I'm Dave Mattingly.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at Metamucil.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at Schwab.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadil in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Culver City, California. In Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo, rebels backed by troops from neighboring Rwanda have claimed control of the eastern city of Goma.
After days of intense combat, the Congolese army has collapsed, and the rebel group called M23 say they have captured the city, which is home to some 2 million people.
Emmett Livingstone joins us now from Goma. Emmett, describe the scene for us, where you're at.
Streets are completely empty where I am at the moment in central Goma. Over the last few days, artillery could be heard coming from the outskirts of the city, and that transitioned into a constant crackle of small arms fire last night, which I'm still hearing as we speak.
Goma has been without electricity for 2 or 3 days, so most people are cowering indoors and struggling to charge their phones. Water shortages are also prevalent and shops are closed. There's been a mass breakout at the prison in Goma and many soldiers have fled or are in hiding. Though the rebel group is claiming that they're in control of Goma, the government so far hasn't communicated.
So tell us more about how this whole conflict developed in the first place and about the rebel group M23.
So it's a very complicated story, but zooming way out, a lot of the violence in eastern Congo has its roots in the Rwandan genocide in 1994 between the Hutu and Tutsi ethnic groups, which then spilled over into Congo. The M23 has its roots in Tutsi-led rebellions in Congo. The group captured Goma very briefly in 2012 and then went underground, but it launched a major rebellion again in 2021. It says that it's fighting to protect minorities. The UN says that the group's latest rebellion, though, has been supported heavily by Rwanda, which has de facto invaded Congo and has thousands of soldiers operating alongside the M23. And they're also using very sophisticated weaponry. On Sunday, they were flying an attack drone over the battlefield. Congo has broken off relations with Rwanda and withdrawn diplomatic staff.
Tell us about why this is happening in this particular region.
No one can say for sure why this is happening, and especially why Rwanda is so heavily involved. But analysts say that Rwanda wants a say in eastern Congo, which is an area full of mineral riches. And they point out that Rwanda wants to apply maximum pressure on the Congolese government. Regional dynamics are also likely at play, with Rwanda competing for influence in the region against rival states.
So how is the international community responding to this?
UN peacekeepers and Western private military contractors have been fighting alongside the Congolese army, as well as troops from African allies such as South Africa, Tanzania, Malawi, and Burundi. But with the collapse of the Congolese army, these defenders are no longer in action. On Sunday night, the UN, the US, and France called on Rwanda to withdraw, but so far no international sanctions have been levied on Rwanda. And Rwanda, for its part, says the fighting near the border is a threat to its security and requires it to maintain, and I quote, a sustained defensive posture. At least 6 UN peacekeepers have been killed, so that's a testament to the severity of the fighting. The military governor of North Kivu province was also killed on the front line.
So what happens now?
Right now, M23 and Rwanda haven't fully subdued Goma, though it's almost certain that they will. They're also advancing in the neighboring province of South Kivu, so there's a real danger of the conflict growing bigger and bigger. There's also a danger of an all-out multi-state war in Central Africa. Congo hasn't yet declared war on Rwanda, nor vice versa, but the risks of that happening are now ratcheting up. Many worry that the impact on civilians would be catastrophic.
That's Emmett Livingstone reporting from Goma in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Emmett, thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump took a victory lap in Las Vegas over the weekend and pledged to deliver on one of his signature campaign promises.
Eliana Calle works on tips, and she has for the last few years.
I'm a server and a bartender here in Austin, Texas.
Calle is also an organizer with Restaurant Workers United.
I would say about 95 at least percent of my income is off of tips.
She says eliminating taxes on tips would help her personally pay rent and save money. And in theory, she supports anything that would put more money into the pockets of low-income workers. But still, she doesn't think this is the right fix.
I think it's more of a Band-Aid on a bullet hole. It would be more beneficial if there were laws for higher hourly wages for restaurant workers in general.
The minimum wage for tipped workers in Texas is $2.13, the same as the federal rate. The overall minimum wage is $7.25. Tipped workers are supposed to make up the difference through gratuities. Trump first floated the idea of no taxes on tips last summer, promising that he would do this right away, first thing in office. The four-word slogan was plastered on billboards, and the Democratic presidential candidate, Kamala Harris, introduced a similar version of the idea. It was so popular amongst a subset of voters that Trump credits it with helping him win the key state of Nevada in the presidential election. And over the weekend, he was back there reiterating his pledge.
Your tips will be 100% yours.
He did not offer a whole lot of details, but said he'll be working with Congress in the coming weeks to get a tax bill that keeps his promise. Large portions of Trump's sweeping 2017 tax law are set to expire at the end of 2025, and that would allow Congress an opportunity to amend existing tax policy. Earlier this month, the two Democratic senators from Nevada joined forces with a group of Republicans to reintroduce legislation that would exempt tips from federal income taxes. That bill has been endorsed by the National Restaurant Association. Sean Kennedy is with the group.
It's something that could bring more people into the restaurant workforce. We are an industry that is chronically understaffed.
But even as the no taxes on tips idea has some support from industry and some bipartisan political support, tax experts and economists don't love it.
It's a solution in search of a problem.
I think it is actually terrible policy.
There is no real economic merit to the idea.
That was Alex Morishanu with the Tax Foundation, Heidi Shierholz with the Economic Policy Institute, and Bill Gale with the Brookings Institution. Here's Gale again.
It's not a good way to help low-income workers because the vast majority of low-income workers don't get tips.
According to the Budget Lab at Yale University, over 90% of hourly low-income workers are not tipped. And that's not the only criticism economists have. They say it'll complicate the tax code and open the system up to abuse over the definition of a tip. But still, the idea has fans. The Nevada Culinary Union welcomes it. Ted Papa George is with the union.
Economists have never worked for $2.13 an hour, so I don't listen to a lot of what they're saying.
Here's his take.
Taxes on tips should be removed and the sub-minimum wage should be eliminated.
He says both are helpful, and he's not going to stop fighting to change that minimum wage, too. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Landfills are using robots that scamper over mountains of trash to find leaking methane. Our climate series, Reverse Course, dives into the trash pile next time on Here and Now.
From your car radio to your smart speaker, NPR meets you where you are in a lot of different ways. Now we're in your pocket. Download the NPR app today.
Good morning, I'm Leila Fadel. After more than 2 months of monkeying around in South Carolina's woods, the last four runaway monkeys out of more than 40 that escaped a breeding facility were tracked down. They appear to be in good health, but it was an adventure. They survived a rare snowstorm and dodged traps during their freedom in the wild. But the monkeys stayed close to home, mostly hanging around the facility they escaped from. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. Election Day 2024 was more than 80 days ago. But in North Carolina, there's still a bitter fight over who won a seat on the state Supreme Court. The Republican challenger, Jefferson Griffin, trails Democratic incumbent Allison Riggs by just 734 votes and wants courts to throw out tens of thousands of ballots. Democrats say the GOP is trying to steal the election. Steve Harrison from member station WFAE in Charlotte reports.
Tori Gramora-Pesa moved to Charlotte from Northern California in 2022. She then voted in two elections without incident. But after voting in November,
I got a postcard in the mail with a QR code on it that said that my ballot was being challenged.
That postcard was from Griffin's campaign. He's a state court judge and is contesting her vote along with roughly 65,000 others. Griffin hasn't pointed to any case of voter fraud, but he argues her ballot and others should be invalidated, mostly because their registrations don't have required identification on file, such as a driver's license number. He's also challenging overseas voters who didn't show a photo ID. Gramora-Pesa is upset.
It's not a matter of I did something wrong or I'm trying to cheat at voting. I've voted in three different elections now perfectly fine. So I don't really understand why this one and just this one result should be thrown out.
The Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals will hear arguments Monday as to whether the ballot challenge should be decided in federal court or in state court, where Republicans have a 5-2 majority on the North Carolina Supreme Court. Riggs, who is ahead in the race, has recused herself from possibly deciding she won. But she has publicly criticized Griffin's challenge, as she did in an interview with voting rights attorney Mark Elias.
The right to vote and to have your voice heard is a fundamental, precious right. And our democracy only works if those in charge respect the will of the voters.
Griffin hasn't commented on the challenge, but GOP political consultant Paul Shoemaker, who advised Griffin's campaign, says it's reasonable for a court to determine if the Democratic-controlled State Board of Elections counted ballots fairly.
I mean, you know, we have judicial review of the legislative process. What's about judicial review of the administrative process and how our elections are handled?
As the dispute has dragged on, some Republicans say Griffin has gone too far. Andrew Dunn was the communications director on an unsuccessful Republican campaign for governor 4 years ago. He says the Democratic Party's talk about threats to democracy are, in his view, usually overblown.
However, this case, to me, is different. This case is about complaining about the results of an election and trying to go back and retroactively disqualify voters who cast ballots in good faith.
Depending on court rulings, votes for the state Supreme Court could be retabulated or a new election could be ordered. Meanwhile, voters like Annie Rickenbaugh of Charlotte wonder if her challenged ballot will still count.
I'm a regular person trying to, like, pay my rent. I don't want to have to deal with this.
She says she went to the County Board of Elections to re-register in the hopes her ballot is never challenged again. For NPR News, I'm Steve Harrison in Charlotte.
This is NPR News.
Thank you.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin. Good morning. Hours after being sworn in and with a stroke of a pen, President Trump suspended the U.S. refugee program. He argues the country doesn't have the capacity to absorb large numbers of refugees. So thousands of people who were waiting to reach safety in the U.S. after years of vetting found themselves in limbo. As NPR's Dia Hadid reports, they include thousands of Afghans who worked with the United States and those who fought alongside U.S. forces.
This is not easy. Sorry.
Soraya asks not to use her full name because her safety is at risk. She used to work on women's rights projects with the U.S. Embassy in Kabul. But she fled the country after the Taliban overran the capital more than 3 years ago. She knew her life was in danger because shadowy assassins, believed to be linked to the Taliban, had been killing women like her even before they seized power. Feminists collaborating with the enemy to spread immoral Western ideas. Soraya went to neighboring Pakistan, and from there she applied for asylum in the US, and it was accepted.
We were waiting for the flight. Unfortunately, now it is like suspended.
Suspended after President Trump suspended America's refugee program. Soraya says she and her family can't believe it.
It's a shock, believe me. It's a shock, and I don't know what to do. If I go back in Afghanistan, I will be prosecuted or even be killed by Taliban.
She says it wasn't meant to be like this. She was meant to be evacuated after the Taliban overran Kabul, but she and thousands of others who had worked with U.S. diplomats and forces in Afghanistan weren't able to get on planes during America's chaotic exit from the country. That exit was set in motion after the first Trump administration signed a deal with the Taliban to withdraw after nearly 20 years in the country. As the U.S. left, service members lobbied for their Afghan allies to be given asylum.
Afghan service members who fought alongside us, bled alongside us.
Sean Van Driver is from Afghan Evac, a nonprofit that helps resettle America's Afghan allies. He says those people also include civilians.
These are lawyers and judges, prosecutors who put the Taliban away.
He says about 200,000 Afghans have already arrived as refugees to the United States. Several thousand more came into the country through a different pipeline. And there's about another 50,000 still waiting for asylum. They're now in limbo. Van Driver says he hopes President Trump's administration
can do a carve-out for our wartime allies.
Many of them, like Soraya, are waiting in neighboring Pakistan. They're not welcome. Pakistan has been deporting hundreds of thousands of Afghans. And Soraya, whose asylum to the U.S. has been suspended, is afraid she and her family will be forced to return.
Police of Pakistan is searching for Afghans. I'm not safe here. And if I go back in Afghanistan, my life is not safe. My kids' life is not safe. What should I do?
Others who were waiting to fly to the U.S. are hiding in Afghanistan. Like Roshangar, he asks we don't use his full name because he's been on the run.
We have been constantly changing our places.
He says the Taliban want his head because
I had worked alongside U.S. pilots reviewing and approving signing airstrikes against Taliban.
Roshangar says he was waiting to do a medical check. It's one of the last steps in the U.S. asylum process. Now,
the Trump administration already turned its back to us. He is unfortunately putting our lives in grave danger.
Roshangar says suspending asylum to people like him goes beyond the harm it will likely cause America's Afghan allies.
I think Mr. Trump is sending messages to his allies that we are not going to keep our promise. We will turn our back to you when it's a dark time.
He says maybe one day, when America seeks help again, former allies, countries and people will turn their backs too. Dia Hadid, NPR News, Mumbai.
The Trump administration has temporarily halted approvals for new wind energy projects in federal lands and waters. That's after the president signed an executive order calling for the pause last week. NPR's Julia Simon says the order may also threaten existing wind projects.
For the past week, wind industry advocates have been repeating one word a lot.
Uncertainty.
That's Jason Gramey of the American Clean Power Association. He says wind companies are still trying to figure out what this means, but here's what we know. The executive order pauses lease sales and permits for wind projects in federal waters and lands pending a review from multiple federal agencies. The order could also impact wind projects on private lands. For example, federal permits sometimes cover projects in the path of a migratory bird or bat. Here's Gramey.
They're potentially saying, let's have a do-over and kind of redo the bureaucracy to permit these facilities that are already underway. So that's troubling.
The order uses misleading language to justify its provisions, incorrectly suggesting that wind is not a reliable energy source. It also suggests that offshore wind harms wildlife. There's no scientific evidence that the offshore wind industry kills whales. Wind energy makes up about 10% of the U.S. electricity mix, and it employs more than 130,000 people. Chris Olith directs the Special Initiative for Offshore Wind, a think tank. She says wind can reduce air pollution that heats the planet.
So it really has air quality benefits, you know, the benefits to mitigating impacts of climate change.
Governments around the world are embracing wind as a reliable source of electricity. For much of last year, wind was the biggest single source of electricity in the United Kingdom. China is also pushing onshore and offshore wind. Meanwhile, Alex Wong at UCLA says in the U.S.
We're taking a U-turn that will really harm these industries, and it'll be hard to compete with China.
Many anti-wind advocates are applauding the order. The Trump administration did not respond to NPR's request for comment. Wind energy advocates say if projects already in the pipeline get canceled, they may turn to the courts. Julia Simon, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
Hello there. Here comes the west wind, yeah.